Han watched as the honor guard ships jumped the three uglies, none of which did a very credible job of responding to the threat. The B-wing ugly ignored their attack altogether and concentrated on firing near misses and the occasional glancing hit at the Falcon. It took only 5 or 6 desultory shots from the lead patrol boat to disable one of the X-ties. Its engines and weapons died, and it drifted off derelict. 3 of the patrol boats took off on a needlessly complex synchronized maneuver and came up under the other X-tie, blasting away. The X-tie managed to land a few shots on the lead patrol boat, and then its left wing blew off. Its X-tie fighter cover gone, the B-wing ugly finally broke its ineffectual attack on the Falcon and came about in rather lumbering fashion. It leveled its cannon at the one patrol boat that hadn't managed to do much besides fly straight, and the little fighter exploded on the first shot. The 5 remaining patrol boats converged on the B-wing from all sides and concentrated their fire on it. The B-wing took several hard hits from multiple directions, and a small explosion amidships sent it into a hard tumble. Then a whole series of blasts ripped through the ship's interior, merging into one huge firestorm that lit up the sky before it guttered down to nothing. The chop-job B-wing ugly wasn't there anymore. Han watched as the surviving patrol boats did a graceful joint victory roll.
"Very nice," he said. "Very nice. Almost makes me want to believe it."
"Millennium Falcon, this is Captain Talpron, leading Squadron 2, Corellian Space Defense Forces Space Service. Are you all right?"
"Just fine. Thanks. Thanks for the rescue."
Han had his own reasons for playing along.
Whose ships were those?"
As if he didn't already know.
"Unknown group, Millennium Falcon. Could be any of the Corellian pirate groups out to score big. They might be from one of the outlier systems."
"Oh, that'll make them hard to trace," Han said sympathetically.
"So it will, Millennium Falcon."
"We're very sorry that you lost one of your craft. We would like to express our condolences to you and to the family of the crew you lost."
"What? Oh, yes, of course. We'll make the arrangements."
Every now and then in the game of Sabacc, your opponent made a mistake, showed a card he should not, and you knew more than you were supposed to. The opposition, whoever that was, had just showed Han some of their cards. Han was not about to let them know he had seen anything at all. He stepped into the cockpit and was not overly surprised to see Leia in the pilot's seat, watching the main viewport.
"Did you have a nice chat with our new friends?" she asked.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "Great bunch of folks. Are the kids okay?"
Leia nodded toward a small repeater screen that showed a view of the lounge. Han could see 3 small figures, their expressions very solemn.
"What the burning skies is going on, Han?"
"Let me into the pilot station, will you? I've got to try something."
Leia got out of the seat and Han settled in.
"Chewie, punch up the tactical playback and run it, will you?"
The tactical display popped up on the screen and showed a schematic diagram of the encounter just passed.
"Watch the uglies. They don't even shoot back when I take a shot at them. The uglies were robot ships, not very well programmed ones. No one was on board those ships. They were programmed to fly to a designated point in space, then open fire with near misses at a ship meeting the Falcon's description. If we had shown up there, it would have worked great."
"But the Honor Guard lost one of their own ships,"
Leia objected. "Another robot drone ship," Han said. "The one that ended up getting shot was the one that flew at the back of the formation on the simplest maneuvers."
"That doesn't prove it's a robot," Leia objected. "Maybe it was just that the least skilled and experienced pilot was the one who got hit."
"Except that the squad leader didn't seem to care about his own pilot getting killed. He didn't seem to know what I was talking about when I offered my condolences. He'll never win any awards for acting."
"All right, assume you're right. The next question is, who are they?"
"This is Corellia. Everything is for sale here. It could be that the highest level of command ordered this, or that they knew nothing about it."
Mara Jade stared at the message cube, wishing she could send it to someone else or make it cease to exist altogether, but she couldn't, not under the circumstances. To be opened in the presence of Leia Organa Solo, self-styled chief of state of the so-called New Republic, Han Solo, and the de facto governor general of the Corellian sector. Code Rogue Angel 7. That message, in old-style Imperial code, was written in neat lettering on the side of the message cube. Mara had unbuttoned the code almost without thinking, but knowing what the word said told her precious little about what the cube meant. Clearly it was from someone who had no great love for the New Republic, but beyond that it was difficult to comprehend. There was another label on the cube, but the writing on it was in a script Mara did not recognize. By the look of it, the Imperial label had been slapped on the package quickly, and one edge of it overlapped a corner of the unreadable one. The cube had been aboard a message drone that had intercepted her ship, Jade's Fire, a day or two after she arrived in the hinterlands of the Corellian sector, headed for the trade summit. The drone had homed in on the Fire's ID beacon, and the message cube itself had been wrapped up in a package with Mara's name scrawled on it. But who had sent it, and why? And why had they sent it to her? She sighed, put the cube back in the safe, and stepped out into the corridor of her ship. Long years ago, Mara Jade had been the Emperor's hand, doing his bidding on 100 missions, carrying out his will in secret. She had been his courier, his courtier, his envoy, his assassin, on more occasions than she could count. And then out of nowhere the rebellion, the Alliance, had defeated the Empire and killed the Emperor. Mara had landed on her feet, more or less, working for the smuggler and traitor Talon Card, and keeping her past life as secret as she could. She had made a reasonably amicable split with Card and established herself as a trader in her own right, running a small, quiet, but highly profitable trading company. It was hard to find much excitement in getting a good price on Habas Root after fighting for the future of the galaxy. Still, she was out in space, the master of her own fate. She paused at the sealed hatch leading to the bridge, smoothed her tunic, and set her face into its usual stern expression. Mara Jade was a strikingly lovely woman, her pale skin accentuating her high cheekbones. Her red-gold hair ran down her back in a thick, heavy, luxuriant braid. People would take one look at her and instantly assume her to be some carefully bred member of the aristocracy. However, Mara had never been one to let the expectations of others get in her way. Mara had a lot of personality traits that had stood her in good stead over the years, but plain old-fashioned curiosity was the one she had been least able to indulge. Smugglers and Imperial agents couldn't afford to stick their noses wherever they wanted. But well-to-do traders could, if they had what others wanted. And Mara had the cube. She could trade physical possession of the cube for knowledge of its contents, and there was always profit in knowledge.
"Mr. Kalkfa," she said to her Mon Calamari navigator, "turn us around, if you please. Direct course for the Corellian system, and let's put speed ahead of fuel economy just this once."
"I can't believe my information is this bad,"
Lando said as they left the planet Asbrian, watching it slide under the Lady Luck's portside wing.
"I mean, what's next? A potential bride who's been dead 5 years? One that's male?"
"Come on," Luke said. "It could happen to anyone. You did make an initial contact with Condren Forek to say you were coming to court her, and she did say yes. It's not your fault she didn't report in when the situation changed." Lando rolled his eyes.
"Sure, anyone can land on the planet, meet with a rich young heiress to discuss the prospect of matrimony, and then find out she's just back from her honeymoon." "No way, I'm the only one with that kind of luck."
Luke laughed.
"Well, you might have a point at that. But you're not giving up, are you?"
"Of course not. Next, we pay a call on the outlier planet Sikoria in the Corellian sector, and visit Tendra Reasons. Assuming she doesn't turn out to have 6 kids, 3 husbands, and a beard down to here."
"No one said anything about a tutor," Jaina said, staring up at the ceiling of the room the children were sharing. "It's supposed to be our vacation." "So what?" Jason said. "We're the leaders of tomorrow or something, whether we like it or not. You think Mom and Dad would give up a chance this big to teach us stuff we might need to help run the galaxy?"
Jaina giggled. She liked it when Jason talked that way, making fun of how seriously the grown-ups seemed to take everything.
She sighed contentedly and rolled over in her nice big bed. Those bunks on board ship had been awfully small.
And there had been that strange trouble at the end of the trip that neither of her parents was willing to talk about. Jason insisted that some other ship had been shooting at them, but that didn't make sense to Jaina. Mom was the chief of state. Why would anyone want to shoot at her? The villa Han and Leia had rented had a fine view of Corellia's capital, Coronet, from the one side, and an even better view of the ocean from the other. It sat on a low bluff, with a pathway affording easy access to the white sandy beach below. Han was on the patio, leaning on the railing and staring out to sea. Everything should have been fine. All the folklore of the spaceways said you were never more comfortable than on your own homeworld, where the gravity, the air pressure and atmospheric gas mix, and language and accent and cuisine and everything else were precisely the ones that your body had been born into. But it just wasn't true for Han, not this morning. And it was more than the incident with the patrol boats and the uglies. That was worrisome, but not as much as it might have seemed at first. After all, they could have been killed and had not been. That meant that some powerful someone definitely wanted them alive, at least for the moment. But there was more, much more. The unkempt fields of Corellia, the unpainted houses, the lines of boarded-up stores a half-kilometer long, the worn look of the people. It was bad, worse than he had thought. Han felt a strange, irrational guilt for not having been here with his people to experience the suffering with them. And suddenly he was taken with an impulse to do exactly that, be with them. He turned and went inside and found Leia still at the breakfast table. "Listen, you think you can handle this tutor thing on your own? I feel like I have to get out of here. Go and see what it's really like in town."
"I was half expecting you'd want to go in," Leia said. "Just don't forget we have dinner with the Governor General tonight at Corona House. The hover car is supposed to come for us at 8 o'clock.
By the time the third candidate for the tutor's position had come through, Leia was already regretting her willingness to take on the job by herself while Han explored his home planet. All were pleasant, but none seemed reliable enough to be trusted watching a kettle boil, never mind dealing with three rambunctious children. Nor did it help that each seemed to undo the others in concocting elaborate compliments for Leia. She pressed the button on the desk that would signal the next candidate. An elderly male drawl entered, followed closely by a jet-black droid. The drawl was fairly tall for his species, about 1.25 meters. His thick, short fur was a deep gray, but with a hint of light gray here and there on his face and at his throat. He wore no clothing or decoration of any kind. The droid resembled a taller, thinner version of R2-D2, a cylinder with wheels on extendable legs. However, unlike R2, this droid could move not just on wheels, but on repulsor lifts. Though as rotund as most of the drawl Leia had seen, this elderly male moved with an impressive bearing, his jet-black eyes calm as he gazed steadily at the chief of state of the New Republic.
"I am Ebrahim."
"I'm looking for a tutor," Leia said when they were seated. "Why should I give the job to you?"
"A fair question. Because the job intrigues me. I know the history of this sector. I have experience in the field of tutelage to well-to-do humans. If I may make an educated guess or two, judging from your background, you wish your children to have a non-human tutor in order to expose them to an alien viewpoint. You want that non-human to be one of the species native to this system, and thus provide insights that no outsider could. I am about the same height as your children, and they will not be intimidated by me. Unless I wish to intimidate them. Are those reasons sufficient, or do you wish more?"
"That list of reasons is quite adequate," Leia said with a smile.
"Good. You have my qualifications listed on that data pad in front of you, I imagine. Do you know enough to make a decision, or do you wish to examine me with those ridiculous force powers of yours and probe the depths of my soul?"
"You do not believe in the Force?"
"I believe in it the way that I believe in gravity or sunshine. I have observed it and therefore know it to be. But I do not take it seriously. In everyday life, for the vast majority of beings, the Force has no real meaning. Your children are strong in the Force, yes?
Very much so.
Then don't let them rely on it too much. It can become a crutch, an easy way out. Let them learn the everyday way of doing things. Let them do as ordinary folk do.
I see, said Leia. It dawned on her that she should have been offended by a number of the things Ebrahim had said, but maybe she had been around the courtiers and flatterers too much. She found his bluntness refreshing. And she realized this was exactly the sort of person she wanted schooling her children.
You have the job.
Then, if you have no objection, I will set to work at once.
No objection at all, Leia said. Ebrahim got down from his chair and turned toward his droid.
Come along, we have work to do.
That is a most unusual model, Leia said. I don't believe I have seen one like it. Might I ask what use a tutor has for an astromech droid?
A great deal of use indeed. His skills at data access alone are beyond value, but his abilities extend far beyond that. He has...
I am capable of speaking for myself, Master Ebrahim. You needn't talk about me as if I were not here.
Leia raised an eyebrow in mild surprise. I don't think I have ever seen an astromech droid capable of speaking basic before, she said, addressing Ebrahim. Does this model come that way? But the droid turned toward Leia.
Your pardon, ma'am, but as I said, I can speak for myself. And I might add that I modified myself for speech as well.
Q-9, that is no way to talk to the leader of the New Republic,
Ebrahim said.
Why not?
The droid's tone of voice made it clear that he was asking out of genuine curiosity.
Because she could order you taken apart for spares, among other reasons.
You would not permit her to do so. That particular empty threat no longer impresses me.
One of these days you will be insulting to the wrong person, and I will not be able to prevent your being punished.
Leia could not help but smile.
While I would suggest you try to be more polite, I, for one, won't order you taken apart.
Q-9 turned toward his owner.
You see?
No, I don't, Ebrahim replied. Being forgiven is far from the same as being right.
Perhaps so, but thus far I have found it is far easier to be forgiven than it is to be right.
That is why people talk to you as if you aren't there, Ebrahim said. They find out very quickly that you are not worth talking to.
Q-9 looked from Leia to Ebrahim, but plainly could not think of a sufficient rejoinder. Instead, he simply turned toward the door and rolled himself out. He must be tremendously useful if it's worth putting up with that much backtalk, Leia said.
Sometimes it's a tough call, Ebrahim replied. But I must admit that I find him an interesting case. I have never encountered a droid with quite his viewpoint. Beyond that, of course, he designs his own improvements. He built those repulsors himself, for example. I keep hoping that the next edition will be a courtesy module. But no luck as yet.
Come, Leia said. I think it's time you met the children.
I am looking forward to it,
Ebrahim said, making a slight bow, inviting Leia to lead the way. Not far from Coronet City Spaceport, Han Solo turned off Meteor Way and walked into Treasure Ship Row. He could not believe it. How had it come to this? Was he even in the right place? Treasure Ship Row had been the market, the bazaar, the entertainment center you had to pass through. Or go around if you had no spirit of adventure at all, on your way from the spaceport into the central city. He remembered the hundreds of stalls that had crowded the center of the broad road, selling everything from every corner of the galaxy. He remembered the vendors, the beings of every kind, from star systems Han had never even heard of, thronging here to hawk their wares. Once the nights of Treasure Ship Row had been just the same as the days, only more so. At dusk, half the vendors would pack up their stalls and then reopen them again as carnival games, sabacc salons, tattoo parlors, betting shops.
The singers and dancers and street players would come out in greater force, and crowds from the bars and restaurants would overflow into the balmy evening air. Now the stalls were no more, leaving a broad and empty boulevard behind. Stores were boarded up, all except those with their windows smashed and those that showed the scars of fire damage. All was silent, except for the blowing of the wind and the scuttlings of small scavenging creatures that hurried into deeper hiding as Han walked down the abandoned street. In the center of town, nearly everyone he saw was human, scarcely a Drawl or a Salonian in sight. Each of the species had always had its own enclave in the city of Corona, but in the old days it had never seemed to matter that much. Salonians would buy groceries in the Drawl shops. Humans would go visit Salonian friends at home. Drawl would come and see a show in one of the human neighborhoods. It was getting on toward the middle of the day as Han's wandering took him toward the business district. He was just on the verge of looking for a place to grab a bite to eat when he heard shouting and chanting coming toward him. The street was emptying out. People were moving quickly as the sound of the march got close. Han heard the slamming of doors, the rattle of window guards dropping into place. A woman scooped up her child and ran inside. Han started to run in what he judged was the opposite direction from the shouting, and ran headlong into them, blundering into the front ranks of the march. The press of bodies was so tight and the crowd so boisterous that he was swept along by the tidal wave of people. They were singing at the top of their lungs, so loud it was impossible to understand the words. They wore cheaply made dark brown uniforms of severe cut. Their feet were shod in metal-toed black boots. They wore black armbands, and on the armbands was the stylized image of a grinning human skull with a dagger clenched in its teeth, and the words, Human League, below. The marchers were all men, and they were making a half-hearted effort to march in rhythm with their song, but they were not well organized, or sober enough for that. The smell of cheap liquor was on every man's breath, mingled with the hot odor of sweaty flesh. Han tried to work himself toward the end of the rank, trying to escape the march and the marchers. He had almost made it when a meaty paw wrapped itself around his collar. It yanked him off his feet, and another paw pulled him on the shoulder and spun him around. Han stumbled and recovered and found himself face to face with a huge, greasy-looking man with bloodshot eyes, a flabby, grimy face, bad teeth, and worse breath. He regarded Han closely, then grabbed another marcher.
"Hey, Flatus!"
"Barnley, watch the way you grab me."
"Flatus, get a look at this guy,"
Barnley said, ignoring his friend's protest. Flatus was a somewhat smaller and greasier version of Barnley. He looked at Han, and his eyes widened in surprise. Han was used to people recognizing him, but these guys didn't seem to recognize him exactly.
Fellas, is there a problem?"
Han asked, shouting in his friendliest voice over the din of the march. Flatus and Barnley exchanged looks. Then each of them grabbed an arm. They dragged him to the side of the street, shoving the marchers out of the way. Barnley threw Han up against the side of the wall.
"Okay, buddy, what's the game? Who are you?"
"No game, no game," Han said. "I was just walking along and got tangled up in your march by accident." Barnley grabbed Han by the front of his shirt.
"Your name, buddy. Your name right now."
"Han. Han Solo." Barnley looked at Han in greasy astonishment.
"Solo?"
He turned to his companion.
"We've got to pull him in. Absolutely. We have got to check this out."
"But wait a second. I didn't..."
But then Han felt a blow on the back of his skull, and the universe went black. The lights were dim when Han woke up in the cell. There was a dull, throbbing pain at the base of his skull and a foul taste in his mouth. He had been in enough cells enough times that he was not particularly terrified by being thrown in yet another one. He was safe in the cell. It was when they came for him that the trouble would start. The precise moment that he had that happy thought, the lights came on, blindingly bright, and the door swung open. Barnley, Flatus, and a third man, whose insignia appeared to show him to be of higher rank, came into the cell, peering at him intently.
"Well, boys," the third man said, "I can see why you did it, and you were right to do it. It could have been a trick, but it turns out it wasn't. Turn him loose.
But...
Flautas protested.
Orders, the third man interrupted. From way up, if you know what I mean.
The blow on the back of his head didn't feel any better this time. The universe went dark again. Dinner was done, and it had not been a cheerful affair. Getting Han patched up from his injuries had put them behind schedule, and they had turned what was meant to be a social occasion into something closer to a council of war. Nor had the noise from outside helped matters. Despite being six floors up, despite the soundproofing in Corona House, the Governor General's official residence, the shouting and the singing of the demonstrators was too loud to ignore. Governor General Macambalecto stared through the window, looking mournfully down at the spectacle below.
There they are, again tonight, and I dare not call in the Corellian Defense Forces or the Public Safety Service. I am not even sure they are on my side anymore.
Leia and Han stood next to Macambalecto, watching as well. Gray wisps of smoke hung in the air, and an effigy of Macambalecto was smoldering, though by now it was so trodden upon as to be scarcely recognizable.
They will march for a bit longer.
A bit longer, the Governor-General went on. He spoke Basic with hardly a trace of accent, but with one or two patterns of Frosian grammar and word order, most noticeably the tendency to repeat a phrase for emphasis.
They'll sing and shout slogans and get drunk and start some fights and break some windows and drift off to wherever they come from until the next time. The next time. But I doubt the streets will be safe tonight.
Macambalecto turned away from the window and sat down at his oversized desk. He was a typical Frosian, tall, gangly, a scarecrow of a figure, a third again as tall as Han, with golden brown fur. Frosians were a fairly standard hominid species, if a rather elongated one. The extra joint in their arms and legs made their movements a bit off-putting at first. To see Macambalecto folded up in a chair with his arms crossed and recrossed through the second elbows was a strange sight indeed.
Without a strong external government to keep the peace, malcontents and rabble-rousers of all sorts are coming out of the woodwork, Macambalecto said. And it is not just our human friends out there. The Drow, the Salonians, and the humans have all produced their demagogues, and they have set to work demonizing each other. For endless years, it was the strong central government that kept the different species from having at each other. The Empire didn't much like non-humans, but it liked anti-alien riots even less. They were bad, bad for business. People learned that if they caused trouble, they would be punished. During the war, Corellians were asked to choose between alliance to the Republic and fealty to the Empire. Now, members of all the species of the Corellia system are asking themselves, why any exterior authority at all?
Macambalecto gestured out the window.
They are starting to ask, why be in the New Republic if it cannot promise order? Why not one planet, one government? Or one landmass, or one species, one government?
Han shook his head mournfully.
I can't believe it. I can look out the window. I know it's happening, but I don't believe it. I was born and raised in a united Corellian sector.
Except that you weren't, Leia said. What Macambalecto is saying is that the Empire forced the Corellians to pretend they were united and at peace. Macambalecto, we cannot allow this to happen, she went on. If the Corellian sector is allowed to disintegrate, the idea of separatism could spread and lead to chaos.
It has begun to spread already, said Macambalecto. Groups of all three species and of other Corellian sector beings are starting to set up independent states in the outlier systems that surround us.
Can't we bring in ships and troops from elsewhere?
Han asked.
That would cost a tremendous amount of money that we just don't have,
Leia said.
Besides which, there's not much call for warships or armies at the moment, thank the stars. Most of the forces have been disbanded.
There is nothing we can do, Macambalecto said. However, there is another point. Another point. Although it sounds as if Captain Solo's capture was almost at random, it could have been a deliberate threat directed at all of you. A warning.
A warning.
You're saying they might be trying to chase us off, suggested Han.
Possibly, Macambalecto said. The staged attack when you first arrived in the sector certainly makes it seem that way.
Well, we're not going to let them win, said Han. I don't cut and run. I say we stay, that we do exactly what we would have done otherwise.
Excellent, said the Governor General. However, I would suggest taking one or two precautions. I know that your ship is under guard at the spaceport, but it is not the most secure of locations. There is a small landing pad and hangar complex here on the roof of Corona House. You could store the ship there.
Okay, then, Han said. I'll have Chewbacca fly the ship over tomorrow morning, first thing. It'll give him something to do. More to do than we'll have, in any event.
Leia smiled, with at least some hint of real humor in the expression. Oh, we have a lot to do, Han, if we're going to keep up appearances.
Like what?
We have to play tourists.
The next morning, Han was waiting for Chewie to come back from moving the Falcon when the tutor's droid approached him.
Master Solo, if I might have a word?
Yeah?
Han asked tiredly as he leaned back in the chair.
I now carry a wide range of highly capable scanners and comparators, and I have performed repeated sweeps of the vicinity in between the execution of my other duties.
Good for you. Han was not really paying attention. Why did every droid feel the need to buttonhole him and yammer on about its specs and capabilities?
And good for you, too, Master Solo. I do think you would be well advised to take what I am saying more seriously.
And why is that?
Because you are being watched.
That got his attention.
If you mean the CDF agents...
Judging by her behavior, I believe the watcher in question is doing her best to stay out of their sight. She has stationed herself in the empty villa a short distance from here. She watches from an upstairs window, doing her best to conceal herself. I managed to record a few low-resolution flat image shots of her in polarized infrared.
Han had expected Q-9 to project a fuzzy holographic image on the wall or something. Instead, there was a quiet whirring noise, and a flat image hologram rolled out of the printout slot in Q-9's chest. It was Kalenda, the NRI agent. What the devil was she up to, and why hadn't she tried to contact Han? The only answer he could come up with was that she didn't trust the CDF either. Han thought for a moment.
You've done very well, Q-9. This is vital information. But I must order you to tell no one else about it.
Then this watcher is an enemy, sir?
No, a friend. I don't exactly know what she intends, but she is on our side. The problem is that we are not at all sure the CDF is friendly. If their agents discovered her, we could lose a very useful asset.
Useful for what?
Han shook his head.
I don't know yet. Before I could tell you what we'll need her for, I'll have to figure out what game we're playing.
Han handed the hologram back to Q-9.
Destroy this. Keep a very low-key eye on our friend.
Quite well, sir.
Thank you, Q-9. You may well have just done the most important work in your life.
The next day, the whole family, along with Ebrahim and his droid Q-9, piled into a hover car the Governor General had loaned them and took off with Han at the controls. Ebrahim had suggested that the best way for the children to learn Corellian history would be for them to visit a large archaeological dig not far from Coronet. The autopilot alert beeped, and an indicator light came on as they got close to the dig. Han looked ahead and saw a huge pit, a dark blot on the landscape.
Ibrahim, is that where we're going?
Yes, sir. At least that looks like what I have heard described.
You've never been here before? I thought you were going to be our guide.
And so I shall be. I have read all the published papers concerning it and talked with many of the principal investigators. It is the first major archaeological site ever studied on this planet, and thus of considerable interest. It is just that I have never before been able to get clearance to get to it.
So you're using the chief of state of the New Republic as your personal ticket into this place?
Han asked, his tone somewhere between annoyance and amusement.
Absolutely. How could I pass up the opportunity?
This is the first ever archaeological dig on the whole planet? Leia asked. How could that be?
I believe it comes from the sudden strong speciesist feelings on Corellia and the other worlds in this system. The past has become an issue of pride. Who was here first? Who has the strongest claim to this or that spot of land or this or that planet?
Political archaeology, Han said. It's a new one on me. What are we going to see down there, anyway?
No one quite knows what it is. It is an extremely ancient system of artificial underground chambers, many of them collapsed or filled in by sediment. Some of the chambers are in quite good condition, however. They are full of machinery of one sort or another, and no one knows what the machines are for, or who built them, or why.
On the surface of the dig, workers, all of them human, were rushing in all directions, moving piles of dirt and debris out of the excavation in big roller cars. Droids of all sorts and descriptions were carrying various sorts of hardware in and out of the huge pit. Leia, Han said under his breath, look at the uniforms on the workers. What about them? They're the same as the ones on the fun boys who roughed me up. The only thing missing is the Human League armbands. A man of middle age, looking rather on the portly and well-fed side, was coming toward them. He was dark-skinned, with short-cropped black hair and a broad, toothy smile.
Greetings to you all. I am General Bryman Yarar. Welcome to our little project.
He bowed respectfully to Leia.
Madam Organa Solo, it is an honor to have you here.
He stuck his hand out to Han.
Captain Solo, an honor as well.
Thanks, Han said slowly as he accepted the proffered hand.
We're glad to be here.
General of what, if I might ask? Were you in the war?
And on what side, he wanted to ask, but did not.
What? Oh, that,
the general said, clearly a bit nonplussed.
An honorific only, I am afraid. An informal title in a private organization.
The Human League, perhaps? Han asked. Yarar's smile dimmed, if just for a moment.
Why, yes, they provide the bulk of our financing. But we try not to advertise that too broadly. Some people might get the wrong idea. But the workers today are from a Human League heritage squad working to reveal our species' glorious past here on Corellia. Are you familiar with our work, Captain Solo?
I'm becoming so, Han said.
And these must be your children,
Yarar said, sweeping on past the awkward moment. He squatted down and gave Jason a friendly wink.
I'm surely glad to meet you all.
Yeah, Jason said, sidling back a bit. Glad to meet you, too. Jaina forced a little smile and left it at that. Anakin didn't move a muscle, but simply stared at Yarar.
Yarar stood up again, still smiling.
Shall we head in? He asked.
Sure, Han said. He noticed that Yarar had completely ignored both Chewbacca and Ebrahim. Maybe the grown-ups found all this stuff interesting, but Jason, most assuredly, was finding his attention starting to wander. At first it had been kind of fun to be underground in the strange old tunnels. That General Yarar guy was all full of excitement and enthusiasm about all the mysterious old machines they had found. But Jason didn't see why. Most of the machines they were finding looked as if they were a million times worse off than the rooms themselves. The lettering, if it was lettering, on some of the machines was hard to make out, and General Yarar told them it wasn't in any alphabet or other writing system anyone had ever found. Even Ebrahim seemed a bit disappointed by the tour. Something else seemed odd to Jason. He had read some books about archaeology and about how you always had to be real careful about leaving everything just as you found it and being sure to go through all the crud you dug out to make sure that you didn't miss some incredibly vital clue that was hidden there. Well, they weren't doing that here. And they weren't, as best Jason could tell, doing much to investigate the things they did find. They weren't even digging them out all the way. It was like they were only digging far enough to make sure that they hadn't found the one thing they were looking for, and then moving on. At first, Jason and his brother and sister had been leading the pack, scooting ahead, eager to see the next room. By now, however, all three children were hanging back, bored by it all. Jason was following behind the adults, with Jaina and Anakin behind him. But then Jason turned around and noticed they weren't following anymore. He went back around the corner of the tunnel to see what was up. Anakin was staring fixedly at a spot on the floor of the tunnel, muttering to himself. "What's he doing?" Jason asked. Jaina shook her head. "I don't know exactly. He just walked over to that spot and stopped dead and started talking to the floor." "There," Anakin suddenly announced, and pointed in the opposite direction of the side tunnel the grown-ups had gone down. He turned and started trotting down it, still staring intently at the tunnel floor. By the time the twins caught up with him, he was already headed down a ramp that led down into a lower level.
"What is he after?" Jaina asked.
Jason shook his head. "I don't know, but I think the General's guys have been looking for something in particular, and I've got a hunch that Anakin's just found it." Q-9 floated along on his repulsors, following behind the tour group, not feeling at his most useful. He was strongly of the opinion that droids should be useful at all times and in all places. Suddenly it registered with him that the children were no longer with the group. For a full tenth of a millisecond, he toyed with the idea of sounding the alarm, but then rejected the idea. Perhaps their hosts would take it ill if they found out the children had been wandering off where they should not have been. No. After all, he had installed all that sophisticated detection and sensing equipment. It was time that he put it to use. Suddenly Anakin stopped dead in his tracks. All the twins could see in the gloomy passage was that he was standing in front of a stretch of corridor that looked exactly like every other stretch they had seen. But Anakin was literally hopping with excitement. "Here," he muttered under his breath. Holding his finger about 10 centimeters away from the floor, he moved his hand toward the wall, and then slowly up it.
"He's tracing something,"
Jaina said in a whisper.
"Up," Anakin said. "I need to go up. Let me up on your shoulders."
Jaina knelt down next to her brother, and he scrambled up on her shoulders. She stood up carefully, Anakin swaying back and forth just a little bit as she overbalanced a trifle. There was a slight shower of pebbles and dust.
"Great! I just got a face full of gravel,"
Jaina spluttered.
"What happened?"
"It's a panel," Jason said. "Like a keypad panel, but different. It's a 5x5 grid of little green buttons."
"Done," said Anakin at last. "Let me down."
Jaina complied eagerly.
"But now what?" she asked. "What happens now?"
And then, with the dull rumble of heavy machinery, a 10-meter-wide section of the tunnel wall in front of them slid out of the way, dropping down into the floor. There was a clattering of pebbles, and a feeble cloud of dampish dust shook loose from the wall. Behind the false wall was a huge, seamless panel of faultless, gleaming silver. Suddenly, a seam line appeared in the silver wall, and a huge section of it swung back. A gleaming light poured out into the tunnel as the door opened, and the children had to shield their eyes for a moment before they could see clearly. Inside the door was a long corridor made of the same silver stuff as the door. The corridor seemed to be open at the other end, but they could not make out clearly what was there. There did not seem to be any sort of place for the light to come from, but it came just the same.
"What is it, Anakin?"
Jaina asked her little brother. He shrugged.
"Don't know. I just felt it there, and I followed it. Don't know what it is."
"Well," said Jason, with far more confidence than he felt,
"we'll never find out here. Come on."
At last they reached the end of the corridor and stood looking down at something that Jason had never seen before. The floor went past the end of the corridor and ended in a view platform about 5 meters across. The platform hung out in empty space with no guardrails or any other sort of protection around the edge. It stood at the apex of an impossibly deep artificial cavern made of the same silver-colored material. The cavern was in the shape of a sharply angled cone, with the platform at the point and the base of the cone on the floor of the cavern far below. Jason let go of his brother's hand, got down on his hands and knees, and crept out toward the edge of the platform. He stuck his head out over the edge and swallowed hard. Far below, he could make out other conical shapes, much smaller than the cavern itself, yet still extremely large. There were seven of the cones, with six in a circle around the central seventh. All of them seemed to have the same height-to-width proportions as the cavern itself.
"What in the name of space have you children gotten yourselves into now?"
Jason nearly jumped out of his skin and right off the platform.
"Hello, Q9. Thanks for almost scaring me to death." He scooted back in toward the center of the platform before sitting himself up and getting to his feet. "Are the others looking too, or just you?"
"No, at least they weren't when I left them."
"Good. Jaina, Anakin, we've got to get out of here."
"But we just got here," protested Anakin.
I know, but do you want General Yarrar's people finding this whatever it is? It's got to be what they're looking for, and it's got to be very big and important."
Anakin thought for a moment, and then shook his head violently. "No.
Uh-uh. No. Can't let that general guy in here."
The three children turned toward the droid.
"Oh, I quite agree. However, I do think it would be best if you allowed me to take as complete a scan as I can before we depart. We might well want a record of this place for future reference."
"Okay," Jaina said. "Do it, but do it quick. Jason's right. We have to get out of here. Come on, Anakin."